You're listening to New Voices in Philosophy, a production of the Extending New Narratives in the History of Philosophy project.
This podcast is sponsored by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada and partner institutions.
I'm Olivia Branscombe.
And I'm Haley Brennan.
In this episode, I speak with Aloran Samantha Forbes, an assistant professor in philosophy and gender and social justice at McMaster University. We discuss the thought of the French philosopher and novelist Madeleine Scudéry, who lived from 1607 to 1701. Though most historians of philosophy know Scudéry for her later philosophical dialogues, we focus on an earlier publication, 1642's Illustrious Women or Heroic Harangues. Aloran argues that this collection of fictional speeches by real women from antiquity, all of whom are limited in some way by hierarchical power structures, is an educational philosophical text that articulates various manifestations of patriarchal power and exemplifies ways of subverting it.
Aloran, thank you so much for being here with us today. Really looking forward to chatting with you. I was wondering if you could start just by telling us a little bit more about yourself and your work. So what is your primary scholarly focus now? And how did you get your start on that sort of area of philosophy?
I describe the way that I approach my research and teaching as doing the history of feminism. So what that means, by the way that people usually think about these things, is that I'm working at the intersection of feminist philosophy and early modern European philosophy. What that means in practice is that I'm interested specifically in women philosophers and other folks who've been left out of the traditional canon, but with a particular emphasis on what we would now describe as feminist philosophical concerns, methods, topics. So things like relational autonomy or marriage or, that sort of thing.
So sometimes people will say, oh, well, we can't talk about feminism in the early modern period. You know, these people didn't identify as feminists. It sounds like you have no issue with that. And I'm just curious kind of how you would respond to somebody who would be concerned with that kind of terminological application.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question that people ask, and I understand why they ask it. I guess one of the things I would say is that concepts exist before they're named. That's how the words come about. Like, we have to develop the language to describe a phenomenon that already exists and that we're thinking about. So that's one thing I would say about that. But another is that the things that we now have language for exist a long time ago because the problems that they're trying to solve or understand are in some ways timeless. Like, I joke that, like, you know, just because feminism, the word, was invented in the like late 18th century or whatever, doesn't mean that women were, or that the oppression of women was. These things are much older and people have been trying to figure them out for a long time. So I think it's fine to use this word. Although if someone says, you know, don't call me a feminist, we should respect that. But they couldn't say that. So we get to decide how to understand them in a way that is faithful to them as best we can. And sometimes that means using words that were developed later.
Sure. And words that now have very nuanced and specific meanings in our own context, which is why it's useful to use them, because they've been developed. Sometimes I think there can be a tendency to like coin a new word or come up with a whole new category, which sometimes might be appropriate, but other times just serves to kind of alienate people from this longer intellectual tradition that they actually are a part of, or arguably are a part of. So that makes sense to me. And yeah, so my next question for you is sort of, how did you get started on this? I mean, were you always interested in the history of feminism as a fledgling philosopher? Was that something that developed a bit later in your career? What was your journey like?
Yes. Well, as a baby philosopher, I wanted to do Aristotle. So this is a funny thing to say now, but I wrote a master's paper about relational autonomy in rape culture. That was the thing that I was most interested in, is how can we think about like how people can be free or unfree in this very particular sense when they're embedded in these oppressive circumstances. But then when I was trying to get into my PhD program, I thought, you know what can I spend many years of my life thinking about? Aristotle on virtue, this is really great. So I went to my PhD program and I was all set to do that for the rest of my life. And then I took this course with the person who became my supervisor, Karin Detlefsen, and we read Mary Estelle, and I was like, it blew my mind. Like, I didn't know that there was a history of feminism until I took that class in, I think, 2015. I just didn't know that women were doing philosophy before the 20th century. And it blew my mind, and I was so excited about it. And, you know, I've been very fortunate to try and make a career out of it. So I feel very lucky, but it was totally a surprise.
Yeah, I'm going to want to talk to you a little bit about teaching later. But first, I want to just hear more about your work. So today we're going to learn a bit more about your work on Madeleine de Scudéry. I'd love to hear a little bit about her before we dive into the philosophy. So who was she and what was her life like?
She's super interesting. So she was born in 1607 and died in 1701. So she lived a very long life. She never married, never had kids. She was at one point the most famous novelist in Europe. So her works were published and translated into multiple languages almost immediately. Like, she was an extremely big deal. So she was born into like a sort of middle class family and worked her way up socially through the salon scene, eventually securing a position for her brother. And then from there, starting her own salon, publishing, making a name for herself. So she wrote a whole huge range of works. So she wrote model letters. She wrote a series of like epic novels with 7 volumes, 10 volumes. She wrote a series of speeches, which is what we're going to talk about today. But what she's most famous for in philosophy is something that came at the very end of her life, or very near to the end of her life, which is her conversations on diverse subjects. And they're like a series of dialogues, which are sort of more obviously philosophical in both their structure and their content.
Great, yeah. One thing I do know about Scudéry and that I was going to ask you about is that her dialogues are the texts that historians of philosophy typically look at. So we're not going to be talking about the dialogues. We're going to be talking about a text that was published, you know, what, like 40 years earlier than some of the dialogues were coming out. Why are you interested in looking at some of her other writings?
Well, so the piece that we're going to talk about today, The Illustrious Women, was published right at the beginning of her career. And it's an outlier in a bunch of senses. So in the format or genre that she's writing, it's an outlier. She never writes these formal orations ever again in any of her works. And she published lots of stuff afterwards, which is kind of interesting on its own. But also because one of the things that to my mind is most interesting and striking about the conversations is that women are given this very epistemically special position in the dialogues. They're often the most important contributors, or the person who brings everything together at the end and restates this position that was worked out through the group. And so they are not just equally important, but in some ways actually are extra important or extra gifted in terms of like which kinds of epistemic capacities they're exercising. And in the orations, the only speakers are women, and they're in very difficult hierarchical circumstances, which I find very interesting. So it's an outlier. And I think that is probably says something about what she saw herself as doing in a different way later on. Like, I think it can tell us how to understand the dialogues and how to understand the novels.
So maybe let's hear about The Illustrious Women. So when did it come out? What kind of text is it? And then we'll get into some examples and start talking about the philosophy.
Right. So it was published in 1642. And what it is a collection of 20 speeches or orations written by or spoken by women who find themselves in sort of existential threats of various kinds. So the women are mostly drawn from classical Greece or Rome. There's a couple from elsewhere in the world, but all of them are women from antiquity. And they are defending themselves or trying to accomplish something given these threats that they find themselves in.
It's interesting because they're the speakers. We're not hearing anybody else's voices. And yet other people's power is very present in the orations. How does that come through? Like, how is that expressed in the text?
So there's two ways that that comes through. The first is in Scudery's voice to us as the reader directly. So each speech is preceded by the argument section and is followed by the effect of this oration section. So she tells us what the circumstances are and what threat the woman is under. And then in the effect portion, she tells us how this woman was persuasive, because of course they were all very successful in a very particular way. So that's the first way. And then the second way is that the women in the context of the speeches, in the context of making their case for whatever it is they're trying to accomplish, they tell the reader or the audience how they understand the threat against them. So in some cases, they are naming the person directly, like, this is what you have done to me, and this is how I am responding to it. Or this is the unjust circumstance, and here is how I am trying to think about what is being done, what can be done, what should be done. So they're very explicit, but so is Scudery in telling us how we should understand other people's power.
Yeah, that's really interesting to me for a couple reasons. I mean, one thing that stands out is just how sort of virtuosic she sounds as an author. I mean, both of those approaches you described really highlight her skill. First of all, you have her kind of setting up a puzzle for herself almost, saying like, within these constraints, how can I construct a rhetorical intervention that can outmaneuver the like very real, very present power that the person, that the speaker is enmeshed in. But then you also have her doing that in this voice of the character, essentially. So she's not only speaking as herself and conducting a kind of academic rhetorical exercise, but there's also this exercise in voice and perspective that sounds really impressive. And with that in mind, I'm curious. So you said that this text is really different from a lot of the other texts that Scudery produced and that it came out early in her career. What do you think this text was for? You might think that it was kind of an exercise, right? That it was like a way that she was flexing her skills and trying to sort of show the range that she was capable of, whether that was for herself or for readers. But I would imagine that you think that there's something more going on here. So what's your take on that question?
Yeah, thank you for this question. So some people who have written about this work have said exactly this, like, look, she's giving us this masterclass in rhetorical theory. She's proving her own chops in a time when women authors were not taken seriously. Like, she is showing us that just because you are a woman, even with the disadvantage of not having a traditional education in a school, doesn't mean that you can't be a great rhetor. Doesn't mean that you can't offer really compelling, powerful arguments. And I think that that's true. But I also think that there's something sneakier going on here. I think that this work is not just establishing her own chops, but also is trying to provide a resource for women readers and in a couple of ways. So I think the whole thing is a masterclass in articulating the structure of patriarchy and how it infects the way that women are able to act and how reasoning needs to respond to that if you're going to be persuasive, if you're going to accomplish things, given the sort of exterior or external constraints that are placed on you in virtue of gendered subordination. But she also says, right in the preface, look, this is a kind of rhetorical work, but it is adapted for women. It is the way that women should speak. It is a way that is responsive to the circumstances that we think women are in. So she's telling us, look, don't expect it to be like rhetoric as you traditionally understand it. Expect it to be adapted for the circumstances that women find themselves in. And if that's the case, then that also means that this is a way for women to have a tool that they can read and learn and then maybe be persuasive in their own lives when they face difficult situations themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. So she's not just saying, here's what I, an exceptional woman, am capable of, but she's saying, hey, women, this is a tool that's open to you as well. And I've given you this buffet of different ways it can be done, and you can learn from them as sort of fits your particular situation. So I was wondering if we could hear a little bit of what she says in the preface. Is there a particular passage that you think really kind of helps us see this purpose of the text, or perhaps subtext that you're describing?
So in the preface, she says, look, I'm presenting these illustrious women to illustrious women. This is a work about women, from women's voices, for women. So I'll quote here. She says, look, yet it may be that men or critics will say to me, if ladies be so naturally eloquent, why do I not make them punctually observe all parts of orations as rhetoric teaches in the schools? To this, I can answer them that they are here more fitly placed. The delicacy of art consists in making believe that there is not at all. You women make curls and rings of your hair, but with such a subtle negligence and agreeable carelessness that it might be judged the wind rather than your hands had been helping nature. Just so here, I have endeavored to make my heroines eloquent, yet I have not thought that the eloquence of a lady should be the same as a master of arts. I have imitated at this time the skill of they who make nosegays, who mix by regular fusion roses and jasmines, the tulips and the daffodil, to the end that from this so pleasing mixture of colors, there appear an agreeable diversity to please the sight. Just so here I have chosen in history the finest matter and most different that I could, and have so orderly mixed and so fitly concealed them that it is almost impossible that the reader shall be diverted. So I take this passage to be saying, look, the way that women are going to offer rhetoric is going to be a little bit different than the way that men do it. But women are already very skilled, given the way that they've been conditioned, in making things appear natural that actually are an enormous amount of work, that actually represent a huge development of skills. You think, oh, look at this like pretty bouquet of flowers. But actually, somebody put a lot of effort into making this aesthetically pleasing. And that requires judgment and understanding and knowledge. That's the same kind of thing we see here. A natural face of makeup looks like, oh yes, she just looks like fresh-faced and beautiful. But actually, that took a lot of skill to do. So there's something sneaky here. And definitely, the way that women are going to do this is going to be representative of skill in a different kind of way, perhaps.
And hearing that passage, it really does sound like she's saying pretty explicitly, like, here are tools that you can use to persuade people who have power over you without them even realizing that that's what you're trying to do. You know, you're not going to be setting up this obvious, on-the-nose kind of argumentative situation where they're entering into a debate with a woman. They can easily shut that down and say, no, this isn't the kind of dynamic that I should be having with you. But as women, you're already skilled, and as you said, this very subtle kind of intellectual work that allows you to, in fact, be maybe more skilled and sophisticated in your argumentation and persuasive in a way that maybe the kind of traditional rhetor would not be. So that just has me thinking, do you see this text as having philosophical arguments or as making a philosophical argument? How do you think about the text in that way? So we're going to look at some examples, and we can talk about this through examples if that works best for you. But you mentioned patriarchy, and it sounds like a detailed understanding and presentation of the way that patriarchy works in each of these cases is one philosophical contribution that Scudery is making. Is there anything else that you're interested in when it comes to, like, the philosophical content or, again, kind of moves of the text?
So I think that each individual speech will make a very clear argument for various kinds of things. But I think that over the whole constellation of speeches, the most obvious, like, philosophical argument or contribution that I see is her offering this really sophisticated critique of patriarchal power. Like, on the one hand, she's allowing us to see the structure of patriarchy and how it works. But on the other hand, she's offering this really compelling critique of how that translates to women's experience. So what I mean by this is, I think that one of the things that she does across all these speeches is that she dials the women who are giving these speeches, their epistemic capacities, like, up to 11. These women are model, like, intellectual combatants. They are, like, perfectly virtuous. They are, you know, rational. They make these really compelling arguments. They offer mastery of traditional rhetoric across these various different ways of thinking about this. But ultimately, they have these external constraints, and they can't accomplish all of the things that they might want to do. But that doesn't mean that they can't accomplish things. It just means that the means that are available to them and the range of possibilities available to them are more truncated than some of their male compatriots.
So it's like there's a mismatch between their capacities and the environment and resources that they have at their disposal or that they're embedded in. So do you think part of what's going on there is, again, kind of a message to women that's saying, just because you haven't accomplished certain things doesn't mean that you as a human being are less capable or less worthy of anything than somebody who's in a position to actualize their capacities, or maybe to make it a little bit more concrete, get what they want, you know, achieve their goals? Do you think that's part of what's going on here as well?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that this is supposed to be an educational tool so that women can see, look, maybe I can't do everything, but I can do things. And these are the tools that you need to adopt and adapt so that you can accomplish certain kinds of things. So I guess we'll talk about some examples in a moment. But in a lot of ways, the first step is recognizing the systems that you're in so that you understand the structure. And then once you can see that for what it is, then the moves that actually are available to you are visible themselves. So I think she's giving us the structure, like the chessboard, the layout of the chessboard. And then she's also telling you which chess moves to make in order to get to the end of the game to, I don't know. I don't play chess.
Well, I loved how you described the text as like a constellation a little bit ago. And I'm wondering whether, you know, one thing that's going on there is she's exemplifying how structures show up in different particular contexts. So it's like we have this very broad structural analysis that's being presented, but then we also are seeing how it plays out specifically. And that allows people in their own situation to say, well, maybe Mariam isn't really my... you know, dealing with stuff that I'm dealing with, but Sappho is dealing with things that I'm dealing with. And you can see then how these same structures that are present and activated in all of the cases produce slightly different constraints or opportunities, even depending on what's going on in the specific case. And I think that's so smart. That's such a brilliant way for her to show people that, you know, you can take this structural information and bring it down into your own context.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it seems like, I don't know, non-ideal theory is one way to think about it. Like the system is bad and we're not going to be able to fix it immediately, but we can try and make it work for us, or at least figure out how to make some changes given the system that we're in. In many of the speeches, what she ends up suggesting through the individual orations is that women ought to, not weaponize is too strong a word, but they ought to weaponize the patriarchal system itself. Mm. So in some of them, the woman has recently been widowed, and that is sort of a turning point position for women, because on the one hand, they're really vulnerable because they no longer have the protection of their husband. But at the same time, it's a position of great potential and power, because they often inherit certain privileges in virtue of this. And she says, look, what you can do is you can use this tragedy and leverage this to actually secure your own well-being and legacy.
So we've already been getting into some examples, but maybe it's time for us to get a little bit more concrete and actually look at some particular orations. So are there, I mean, you said, I think there are 15, is that right? How many orations are there in total?
There are 20 in total.
Oh, okay.
So
way more than we could talk about today, but that's okay. I mean, listeners will have to go read them for themselves. Something that I'm definitely going to be doing. But so which ones would you like to talk about? Which ones do you think kind of illustrate some of these philosophical themes the best, or which ones do you want to cover today?
So I would suggest that we talk about Mariam's speech to Herod and Sappho's speech to Erinna.
Perfect. So let's just start with Mariam. Can you tell us a little bit about the story there? And then if we could read an excerpt, that would be great. But then I just want to hear kind of about, again, like the philosophical point or sort of upshot of each, and how you think it's fitting into this larger argument that Scudery is making with the text.
Yes. So I'll begin by reading a little section from the argument, the preface section of the speech. So Scudery tells us, few people are unaware that Herod had his wife killed, but no one knows what she said in her defense. Of the two historians who discuss her, one did not live during her time, and the other was one of her husband's flatterers. Therefore, it is our responsibility to look for truth between the ignorance of the one and the malice of the other. Myself, I confess that I count myself on the side of Miriam, and whether through pity or through reason, whether blinded by her beauty or enlightened by her innocence, listen to her speak, I beg you, and observe her noble pride, the true characterization of the humor of Miriam. So what Scudery is telling us here is, look, everybody knows that she was murdered by her husband, but we don't actually know what happened. We can't, because the way that people have done history is inflected by systems and structures of power. One of the historians literally did not know what happened, and the other one was propagandizing the guy who murdered her.
Great, great, great start.
So, I mean, especially in the context of this podcast, I mean, I think she's making this point about narratives and history and who gets to tell stories. Stories are so powerful. They shape how we understand ourselves and our, you know, the canons that we work with, like who we are, the groups that we belong to. It becomes mythology and like knowledge in this really deep sense. They're epistemically sticky. Thomas King says, an indigenous scholar, he says, the truth about stories is that that's all we are. And I think that that's the kind of point that Scudery is making here. Like stories constitute people, their character, how we understand them. And who gets to tell the story determines what is known.
Yeah, I mean, I love that. And that's definitely, it's so clear that she's saying, as you suggest, you know, the record is going to reflect instances of patriarchal power. But it's our responsibility to look between those instances, those manifestations. And who better to do that than women who know so well, right, that what ends up getting put down in the historical record, what ends up getting published for the most part in this period, is stuff that's channeled through patriarchal power, not things that are representing the experiences and ideas of all the other people in the world. And I also think it sounds like she's saying, to kind of get back to the larger point that you're making about the purpose and function of this text, like read between the lines a little bit. Like I'm giving you tools. She's reminding readers to have that subtlety in mind as they're reading these texts. So that was from the argument. So that's in Scudery's voice. What about what Miriam actually says?
So Miriam follows through on what Scudery tells us is actually happening, perhaps unsurprisingly, because they're both Scudery. But so Miriam says, look, I'm here defending myself. I am fully aware of the circumstances. I know actually that no matter what I say or do, you're definitely going to murder me because you have already murdered my whole family. Like it's just a matter of time. So she says, look, I'm concerned not with trying to actually preserve my life, but with trying to preserve my reputation. And so it's very interesting that she says this, because if Herod, the ostensible, the named audience of this speech, if he's not reachable, then who's she talking to? It must be that she's talking to the audience now, the people reading the speech, i.e. like what Scudery just told us is happening. So she tries to rebut these arguments that are being wielded against her. And she does so in a systematic fashion. Like, okay, well, you said I sent a portrait of myself to Mark Antony. Okay, well, who painted it? Who sent it? When did he send like a gift basket of muffins to thank me? Like, what did prove it, you know? Yeah. And he can't prove it because she didn't do it. So the point is like, look, there's this narrative that is available and you are using your power to push it, to legitimize this thing that you were already going to do. And we all know you were going to do, but here I am trying to resist this sort of long-term thing, not the immediate harm, which is definitely the murder that is about to happen, and which did happen, but this sort of legacy of who she was and what was possible for her and what she was capable of.
It's really interesting to think about reputation here. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing for Scudery to be focusing on, because as is pretty obvious, I guess, from the okay, the stories, first of all, which so often are like ending in the person's death. So there's no chance of actually rehabilitating the reputation of these women. So what do you think she's doing there? Is she saying women in general can change the way that they're perceived? Is she saying we as women, the audience of the text, can have a different opinion of ourselves by understanding the reputation of these historical women differently? What do you think is going on there?
Well, I mean, I think she does take herself to be rewriting the history that has been received about many of these women.
Setting so I think that that's like, in a way.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Like telling the real truth as she imagines that it could have happened. Mm-hmm. But I also think that you're right to suggest that it is helping women see themselves in a different kind of way. Mm-hmm. So we'll talk about the Sappho speech in a bit, I suppose, but she's very clear there that like, look, there's been this propaganda throughout history that is very mindfully constructed to keep women in a hierarchically subordinate position. And you need to see through that and try and take some steps, even if you can't take all the steps, even if you have to take steps in very particular kinds of ways, given the systems that you're embedded in. But there are things that you can do. You can reclaim your reputation. You can reclaim what is possible for you. And I think the point, and this is maybe a bit rosy, I think the point is that collectively, like, we can do this together. If women are working together on this, it's not that we're going to be limited by these systems.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, again, to go back to thinking just about the form of the text, it's a collection of speeches. So there is a sense in which, you know, anything that's happening in any one of the orations in the context of the text as a whole is actually happening in this like interesting collective intervention into history that couldn't have happened in any particular time and place because these people were unconnected or were living at different times in history or far apart from each other or whatever. But one of the benefits of doing this kind of historical work, which I'm getting kind of meta here, but like, you know, this is exactly what you're doing with your work in the history of feminism, is putting these stories together and seeing what can we do by creating a collective where there wasn't the potential for a collective in the historical period itself. And okay, so you started talking about Sappho. Just in the interest of time, maybe we should move to Sappho.
Right. So this is the speech that scholars tend to talk about the most. It's seen as like a direct line from Scyrae to the reader because Sappho is the name that she went by in her salon. Yeah. So it's often read as like a direct, she's telling you this is what she specifically thinks. And the context of the speech is Sappho's trying to persuade this young woman, Erinna, not to give up on poetry. Because, you know, women actually are capable of this. These male-coded things like poetry and arguably philosophy, you can do it. And let me show you how that's the case. So it proceeds in two parts. First, a general argument about what women are capable of and what they would be capable of if they were given the same formal opportunities like education. And that's how people usually read this speech, is an intervention in the Carole des Femmes, the education of women bit. And then the second half is why Erinna specifically should pursue her poetry. And then, of course, she does. Erinna is famous, even if she's not necessarily as highly discussed as Sappho still is. But she was quite a famous poet, second only to Sappho. So the bit that I think is most interesting about this speech, philosophically speaking, is the way that Scyrae is exploring beauty and the kind of passivity that seems to be prioritized or valued in women in this context. So she says, "Those who say that beauty is women's share and that the fine arts, great literature, and all the sublime and exalted sciences fall under the dominion of men, without our having the right to claim any part of them, are far from both justice and truth. If this were so, all women would be born with beauty and all men with a strong disposition to become learned. Otherwise, nature would be unfair in her allotment of these gifts. Nevertheless, we see every day that ugliness can be found in our sex and stupidity in the other. If it were true that beauty were the sole advantage we might receive from heaven, not only would all women be beautiful, but I believe that they would be so until death, that time would spare them, in what he is every moment destroying, and that being sent into the world for no other reason than to let their beauty be seen, they would be beautiful as long as they were on earth. So she says, look, it can't be the case that women are to be looked at. They are to be beautiful objects for the consumption of men, and men are for the creating of great objects, works of art, etc., which ostensibly celebrate women or are inspired by women, because they're ugly women, they're stupid men. So that can't be right. That would just be ridiculous, wouldn't it? And also, like, you know, time comes for us all. So, you know, you don't stay beautiful forever. But I take the real point here to be, look, when we're looking at, and this is something she explores later in this speech, when we're looking at art, like a beautiful statue of a woman or a painting of a woman, we're not like, oh man, what a beautiful woman. We say, oh wow, look at the great art, like the artistic skill, the craftsmanship. Oh, how did he make marble do that? It looks like fabric or whatever it is. So it's this, there's something like very strange going on here, that women are persuaded that what they're for is something that actually traps them in a position of subordination rather than a thing that actually celebrates them, that would allow them the same share in power, public participation as with men.
Interesting. So if I'm understanding you, one of the points that you're making is you might think that art that is framed as an ode to women's beauty is a way that women can kind of get in on the glory or have some good outcome in a situation where they're otherwise pretty limited in their options. But you're suggesting Sappho or Scudery via Sappho is actually saying that's not even that great, because even those supposed odes to your beauty are really just chances for the artist to show off their virtuosity. Is that the idea?
Oh yeah. She says, look, this is the fabrication of men who wanted to make us think that. This is like a very clear effort to make women think that their role is so special and valuable, but it's tricking them. And then it has them buy into this. And then you end up with this like stacking effect. Not only can you not see what is possible for yourself, because you think that you're supposed to be for men, for being beautiful, to be observed, but also if that's the way that we've set up society, then how are you going to have any evidence for women being capable of anything else? You're not, because they're all going to be modeling instead of creating the art.
Well, and there's another interesting kind of move here too, which is in this oration, Sappho is saying you should create art. So there's something valuable still in the kind of beauty that men are capturing or creating, women are capturing or creating.
Yeah, exactly. So she doesn't think that beauty is bad or that art is bad. She thinks that the deception is in having women come to think of themselves as being only fit for this certain kind of public role, which is to be observed, for them to be art as opposed to create art. And like beauty, she thinks that there's nothing wrong with beauty in the sense of like capturing truth, but she thinks that women shouldn't think that their value is in the beauty that is consumed. Their value is in being active and creative. As she says, it's better to find the glory in yourself than to wait for it from others. Like your position should not be defined by other people. You should not wait for other people to say good job. You should go out there and do stuff and prove that you are valuable, contributing to the sort of standard public discourse, as opposed to being an inspiration for it.
So how do you think this fits into the larger argument of the text? So is what's happening here something like another option being presented to women, saying, here's another way that you can express yourself in enduringly?
Yeah, I think her point is that there's a collaborative project to be engaged in here amongst all women. And look, here we have a model of one woman trying to persuade another woman of what she's capable and what is appropriate and possible and valuable in a way that is resistant to the kinds of standard norms about women in her time. And I think she's also suggesting that, like, if women were able to be this resource for each other, that's not going to change the fact that they're enmeshed in this patriarchal system, but it is a way to find respite, to find affirmation and value in each other in a way that is a really helpful and important resource for folks who are stuck in politically or socially or economically difficult relationships.
Okay, that makes sense. So it's not just the argument about art. It's not just the argument about women and their ability to make art and the kind of beauty and value that art has. It's also about, as you were talking about before, kind of the social political context that's happening here and how women can, you know, the intersubjective aspect is really important as well. Not just kind of like what one person can do, but what we can do for each other. That makes sense.
Yes. And also hopefully helping women be critical of the customary norms of the day, right? Mm-hmm. People say that, you know, you should be appealing to men so that you can get married, so that you can have babies, so you can have a good life. And, you know, if you want to do that, that's great. But I think what she's saying is, look, you should be skeptical of people who tell you what you are for and what is possible for you, because some people have a vested interest in you not knowing certain things about yourself or about the group that you belong to.
Yeah. So is there anything else about either of those two orations that you want to draw out even more? Is there something that you feel like we haven't touched on that you think is really important to understand?
Well, I think that in some ways there's a helpful conceptual resonance between the two of them. So the main point in Miriam's speech is, I take it, this point about like narrative and power and who gets to tell us what is true and how knowledge works. But we see that in a different kind of way in Sappho's speech to Erina also. There's this standard story about what women are for and what their appropriate role is. And that is a story that has been told and has a vested interest in being told by very certain sets of people. And I think that she's saying, look, not only should we be skeptical of this, but you should recognize that sometimes these power dynamics are so deep that it's hard to recognize. She says, Look, those who own slaves instruct them for their own convenience, and yet they whom nature or custom has given us as masters would have us extinguish in our minds all the brilliance that heaven has put there and would have us live in the heaviest shadows of ignorance. If this is to obtain our admiration more easily, then they don't achieve their aim, for we cannot admire anything we do not understand. And if it is also to make us more subservient, then this is not a noble motive. And if it is true that they possess some authority over us, it makes their dominion less glorious to reign over only the stupid and ignorant. So she's like, I think she's making this point very explicitly. Look, there's this story about what women are like, and it's supposed to hold them down. But not only is it not good for women, and women need to recognize this and take steps to do what they can to ameliorate it, but also it's bad for men. Like, if it's to keep women in this subordinate position, they're shooting themselves in the metaphorical feet. And it serves no one's real interests for this gendered hierarchy to persist.
So one of my personal favorite things about studying historically marginalized philosophers is the way that reading their work as philosophy gets us to think critically about what philosophy is, you know, what kinds of texts count as philosophy, but also what are we doing? Like, what is this thing? And I'm curious if you think there are metaphilosophical lessons to be drawn from working on someone like Scudery, and in particular working on this text.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I still don't think I'm 100% confident in what philosophy is, but I know that it's a lot bigger and broader and deeper than what we have historically thought it was. So, I mean, I guess one way to think about it is like philosophy is content-based, right? It's the kinds of questions that we ask. It's the sort of, you know, epistemological questions or metaphysical questions. How do we understand ourselves in the world? And if that's what philosophy is, then I think that this work counts because it reckons with many of those. But if it's about genre or method, then that's a harder question. But I think that this still counts because if it's method, if it's argument, if it's, you know, this very highly structured thing, then we see that here. There's the sort of one level of argument where she tells us how we're supposed to understand it, but then there's also the arguments interior to the speeches. And if it's genre, then I guess I'm not 100% sure why speeches wouldn't count, because they capture both the content and the methods that we tend mm-hmm. to associate with philosophy.
We don't have a ton of time, but I'm just curious, have you taught Scudery in any of your classes? And if so, how did that go? If not, do you have any ideas about ways that people could incorporate her into their classes?
So I actually haven't taught Scudery before, which is sort of surprising because I love her so much. but I plan to this fall.
Sure.
So I guess one thing that is similar and which I think I'm going to try with Scudery this fall is I did have students do a live performance of one of Cavendish's plays, The Convent of Pleasure. So fun. Highly recommend. And I think I'm going to see if students are going to, I mean, again, it'll have to be on a voluntary basis because some students aren't comfortable with this, but I think we're going to have people perform some of the speeches.
Yeah.
And then I have a live discussion of what the arguments are and how to understand them and what we think they're doing and why we think they're doing it.
So one question that I have, so like what class will this be in? I mean, what would be some of the main themes that you would want students to focus on?
Last year, I taught a course called Modern Women Philosophers, which is, it's just women philosophers from the 16th to the 19th century. And it was themed around freedom and various different ways of thinking about it. So epistemic freedom, moral freedom, political freedom. So I would suggest that thinking about freedom in a very broad sense, which is a theme that I'm almost certainly going to explore in my early modern philosophy class this fall. I think that that's sort of a broad way to think about the content of these speeches or of Scudery generally, because even when she's not obviously talking about political topics like freedom, the way that we tend to think about it in this period, she's still exploring what it means to be unfree and what we can accomplish with the limited amount of freedom that we might have, in a way that is exciting and I think helps students see the stakes of these sort of academic debates in a way that is not necessarily obvious to us. Like, we're already in a democratic society, so people arguing why maybe a monarchy is not the best system, they don't necessarily feel that that's a live debate.
Yeah. I have two more questions. So the first question is just, do you have any suggestions for starting points for people who are interested in working on Scudery? And it sounds like, you know, this text might be a great place to start. But with that, are there good editions or translations that you recommend?
Yes. So some of the speeches have not been translated into English in a more modern sense. There are there are editions that are available online and like Evo basically. But the Donaworth and Strongson, sorry, but am I sponsored? Okay, so Donaworth and Strongson have a great edition in the Other Voice in Early Modern Europe series, which includes some of her letters, some of the speeches, and some of the rhetorical dialogues from the conversations. So those are great, highly recommend that. If you're looking for like a general text for early modern philosophy in which Scudery appears, the Broad View Early Modern Philosophy Anthology, edited by Marcia Lascano and Lisa Shapiro, includes, for example, Scudery's dialogue on the knowledge of self and others.
Perfect. So that Other Voice in Early Modern Europe would be just kind of a great compendium where you can get a little bit of several of the kinds of texts that Scudery produced. And then if you're a teacher interested in actually assigning some texts, that Broadview Anthology is a great resource. Awesome. So the last question is related to assigning texts. And this is kind of a funny one that we ask all of our guests. But okay, so here goes. If you could mandate the assignment of one text to all philosophy students in your university's program, what would that text be?
Oh, no, that's such a hard question.
You don't have to take it too seriously. Just first thought, best thought in this time, in this context.
Okay. Would it be bad if it isn't Scudery?
Not at all. It can be whatever you want. It doesn't even have to be a woman.
Oh no. It's definitely gonna be a woman. What kind of question is that? I guess I would say Reflections Upon Marriage by Mary Estelle, because it's spicy in a really funny kind of way.
Yeah.
But also it walks the line between traditional sort of treaty style text, but also it uses irony and humor and, I don't know, anger also in a way that I find deeply appealing. It makes it feel like, oh, these stakes are live.
Yeah.
And marriage is like timeless, right? People are still getting married.
So and people still debating whether or not it's a good idea.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, is there anything else that you want to say before we close?
No, just thank you for having me. This has been such a pleasure and an honor. And I've enjoyed it enormously. I hope I've been a good guest.
You've been wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with the audience. I'm really excited to share this episode with them.
Thank you for listening to New Voices in Philosophy. Production of the podcast is funded by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada as part of the Extending New Narratives in the History of Philosophy project.
This episode was produced by me, Olivia Branscombe.
The music you hear is 17th century female composer Elizabeth Claude Jacquet de la Guerre's Sonata No. 2 in D major, performed on the violin by Pizzeria Armonici. For more information about the project and for future episodes, please visit our website, newnarrativesinphilosophy.net. We look forward to discussing all these new figures and ideas with you.